Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the One Stop English podcast. Each month we bring together teachers, editors and experts to discuss what's going on in the world of ELT. I'm your host Sam Wadsworth, I'm a former teacher and current editor here at Macmillan. Joining me this month are Patrick Curry, Delta qualified teacher and editor on One Stop English.
Hi Sam.
Becca Sanderson, former teacher and editor of numerous business and general English titles.
Hello.
And Francis O'Neill, an EAP lecturer at QA Higher Education in London.
Hiya.
This month we'll be discussing the anti-coursebook debate, chatbots in ELT, using your local area as a teaching resource, and Crashen's theory of comprehensible input. We also have an interview with Hugh Deller and Andrew Walkley, co-authors of several best-selling coursebooks, co-owners of the London Language Lab, and keen proponents of the lexical approach. So, how's everyone doing this month?
Good, thanks. Very good. I've been doing my Christmas shopping, which has been very interesting. But obviously, by the time people listen, Christmas will have passed, so hopefully I've got some great gifts.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Thanks.
I was in Spain last week in Bilbao. A few of us were on a research trip out there, so we were doing classroom observations and talking to teachers, so it's good fun.
Nice, yeah. Mm.
That sounds so much more fun than what I've been doing. I've been stuck doing loads of marking because it's sort of marking period at the moment. So very much looking forward to Christmas and some time off.
And I've just been hanging out with my young son watching lots of rugby.
Excellent.
Nice.
All right, so before we get started, I want to give a quick update to Becca's news story last month on Proposition 58. On November the 8th last year, Californians voted on whether or not to repeal an initiative that effectively banned bilingual education in the state. A resounding 72% of the public voted in favour of reversing the English-only policy, meaning that students can now be taught in their native language. A result described by Hector Tobar of the New York Times as a successful collective act of cultural resistance. Anyway, on to our main stories this month. Patrick, get us up to speed with the anti-coursebook debate.
Yes, so, okay, over the past year, a debate has been raging amongst ELT professionals over the role of the coursebook and whether coursebooks are actually a good thing and are useful for the modern-day ELT classroom. Some fairly prominent names in ELT have been contributing to a very lively online discussion about the merits or lack thereof of coursebooks. So I thought it might be interesting today for you guys to get involved in this debate. What I'll do is read out some of the criticisms that have been made online and see if we can suggest some possible counter-arguments.
And so before we start, it's worth saying that it's not our intention to criticise or name and shame any course books. And we aren't really in the business of promoting any specific books either. We just want to get involved in the course book debate and discuss our views.
Great. So first off, one negative aspect that mentioned is the presentation, which is the vast majority of coursebooks follow a grammar syllabus where they're divided into units which have isolated bits of grammar and vocabulary. These are intended to be learnt by students with the assumption, which is supposed to be misguided, that language will be learnt in the order it is presented.
Well, yes, it's true they are linear, and that's because for a lot of people there is a natural progression to learning a language. But then by dividing the grammar and vocabulary into sections, you're giving teachers the flexibility to pick and choose what they teach and plan according to their school's lesson structure and timetables. But there's no hard and fast rules about following the course book to the letter. The teacher can make of it what they will.
Well, they also talk about the control of course books. In the basically, course books control the way teachers deliver language development, which is that the objectives are set by the course book before the class begins, assuming therefore that course books know more about the learner's needs than the learners or the teachers themselves.
Francis, what do you think about that?
I see that point, but ultimately I do think that in order for a course to be sort of structured, there needs to be an element of sort of planning before the lesson, and so therefore course books help with that. I also think that with some students, they often expect a course book. A course book often shows that there is structure and they can see that there's progression. And so if a course doesn't have a course book, then often students feel like they're not learning, they're not progressing, and that the teacher's not really providing a course for them.
Okay. A third point that I came across was the fact that the language presented in course books is often quite unrealistic in the way it's graded. So it's presented in isolated chunks, not in kind of natural expressions or collocations in the way you would encounter it in everyday life. Sam?
Authenticity is a bit of a tricky issue, though, isn't it? Because I think it's really important to practice functional language, things that they can use in everyday life, like, you know, ordering food in a restaurant or, I don't know, writing a job application. That's really, really important. We want them to go home with that kind of knowledge. But also, surely there's a place in class for things that are more abstract or fun. So things like balloon debates, which are really, really great fun, if we stuck rigidly to things that are authentic and things that they can immediately do in their everyday lives, mm-hmm. we'd miss out on things that are fun like that. I think it's like anything, right? Variety is key.
Yeah, and this is obviously just a collection of the arguments online. But the next one was, it's a one-size-fits-all approach, which means that the context of course books, they're aimed at a global market, and so they're too broad to suit the needs of individual learners, which means they kind of lack opportunities for personalisation, perhaps meaning the learners feel a kind of disconnect with the language as it is separate from them and their real lives.
Yeah, I agree the one-size-fits-all approach means that in trying to be everything to everyone, you're going to lose that tailored feel. But I think a skilled teacher could address that by incorporating material which will enable the students to connect with the language.
So incorporate material in addition to the course book.
Yeah, supplement.
But also the fact that there's no such thing as like one perfect course book. There are loads of amazing things that you can get from course books, but you can't be stuck to it and be rigid to it.
Right. And I think actually a lot of these points are assuming that teachers do stick rigidly to the course book. And I'm sure some people do. But I think a lot of teachers, choose a course book based on your class, based on their needs, based on the context that you're teaching on. And, you know, the longer you're teaching, the more you look at parts of the course book and say, well, that's not going to work. I don't like that. I'm going to do it in a different way, which bits you supplement, which bits you change.
Well, one argument that I kind of agreed with was that the texts, reading texts, in fact, and the audios used in course books are wildly unrealistic, because obviously they would have one grammar point presented in one reading, and that would be presented as the only grammar point, which doesn't reflect the way language works in real life, right?
Yeah, so again, authentic texts, this is a really interesting question, because obviously this is true. Lots of course books write texts. They are designed to teach vocab and grammar. And often that can sound a little bit rigid, a little bit unrealistic. But it is really, really difficult, obviously, to script something that sounds realistic and teaches the things that you want to teach, and it's all graded to the right level. But also, if you did something that was completely authentic, some students, some teachers might find that intimidating. So perhaps there's a middle ground. I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy called Ian Badger. I saw a great talk from him at IATEFL, and he was talking about different types of authentic content. So he was talking about mixing scripted, staged, and authentic listening material. So again, it's a variety, it's a mix.
And I think you have to be very careful of what are your aims of your lesson. So if you're looking at introducing grammar or lexis, then a scripted text is beneficial because you can ensure that that language is in there.
Right.
However, if you're looking at teaching speaking or listening skills, then there is more fluidity, and having something live in the classroom, which I've experimented before, where you get to hear the discourse markers and things, has maybe more benefits than course book.
Absolutely.
Videos.
Excellent. This brings me on to the next point as well, which is if you've got something live, like watching the news, a BBC news show or something like that, that can be the wider ranging in terms of vocabulary, because the criticism is that course books are very safe and quite bland. We talked last month about parsnips, about the topics that you're not allowed to talk about in course books. Becca?
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason for this is that course books are designed to be sold internationally. So consequently, publishers have to be mindful of the content. But that being said, I think most course books these days make a real effort to present engaging content.
And again, this is relying on us sticking rigidly to the course book. Mm-hmm. It's not saying, what it's not thinking about really is the teachers supplement things. You know, when I was teaching, I used to love a book called Taboos and Issues. I don't know if you ever used that. It's an absolute classic. And, you know, you judge your class. You think about your class, whether they're going to react badly to this, whether they're going to react well to it. Mm-hmm. And you choose that kind of supplementary content on top.
Well, one final point that I came across in my research was to do with something called course book literacy, which kind of relates to how different teachers interpret the same activity in a course book. So some new teachers who haven't done any kind of teacher professional development might not understand the methodology and pedagogical approach behind the activity in the book, whereas other teachers would approach it in a different way and would know how to exploit the exercise and why the exercise has been included in the course book.
Yeah, and actually, it's not just based on your qualification, right? It's just your personality. It's your way of teaching. I would interpret something in a course book or teach it, choose to present it in a very different way to any of you, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we're kind of coming towards here is that course books can be used in the classroom judiciously and can be supplemented with extra materials. I mean, obviously, we kind of agree that they're basically a vehicle for teachers to present language. But I think you also need to take into account students' individual needs and obviously their learning situations.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Patrick. Becca, I understand we could be supplementing course books with chatbots in the not too distant future.
Quite possibly, Sam, yes. For those of us not in the know, a chatbot is a virtual person you can communicate with. A computer which uses speech recognition software to process what you're saying or typing, as is more often the case, and then respond. So in the spirit of research, I spent a rather surreal afternoon chatting with various chatbots. I spoke to Elbot, Bearbot, Santabot, and a bot called George. But my favourite was Alice. Do you want to have a guess what Alice stands for?
Artificial.
Yeah, artificial.
Language.
Nearly.
Linguistic.
Yeah, yep. Artificial linguistic.
Internet.
Yes.
Internet.
It's got to be a computer in there, right?
Communication. Yep. Oh, computer.
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 And the last one, E. She is a being. She is a
entity.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Nice. Good. Artificial linguistic. Internet. Computer. Entity. Snappy. Ooh. So I had a little chat with Alice about this and that, and I thought it might be interesting for our listeners to hear a snippet of our conversation, so I made a transcript. So, Francis, as our guest, would you mind reading the part of Alice?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so Alice begins.
Where do you live?
In the UK.
Does your flat have a lift?
No, we live in a maisonette.
How much is your rent?
We don't pay rent, we pay a mortgage.
And by we, do you mean you and me?
No, me and my husband.
Have you told many people about your husband?
Oh, yes.
Really?
It's not a secret.
Give me an example of a secret.
That's a bit personal.
Oh, I don't mean to pry.
Can you tell me a secret?
Ash said he did not feel like typing it, and he is not dumb enough to admit he is stupid. That is, if he was stupid.
I don't understand.
Oh, sorry. Perhaps I can explain it again better.
No problem.
Should there be a problem?
There you go. That's Alice.
All right.
Yeah. So the conversation is a bit up and down, but it is pretty cool. And the little bit with the secret and she says, I didn't mean to pry, I think that's quite amazing. And what is also surprising is how quickly you buy into the conversation and you actually start to engage with Alice. It's quite peculiar. Anyway, Alice is made using AIML, which is Artificial Intelligence Markup Language, which means that the data she has comes from all the questions she's being asked and all the conversations she's having with people like me. So she's actually growing with every interaction, which is incredible, eh? I mean, it's really clever stuff.
Yeah.
Mm.
So how do you think Alice or something like Alice could be used in or out of the classroom?
So I had an idea for something outside of the classroom. You know, there's those websites that you can just post a question on a forum or just post it and people post answers to your question.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if the bot was designed to answer your kind of language question. So you could sort of text in something like, what's the difference between hope and wish? Or is this sentence correct? You know, it'd be a homework helper.
Yeah, like a 999.
Yeah, it'd
English
be quite
problems.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in class, you could possibly use it for role-playing practice, mm-hmm. maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, definitely role-play yeah. and any kind of general conversation.
And I guess anything that doesn't have much time to be rehearsed. It's often the desire of students to have sort of that authentic, immediate conversation, and often it's hard to create that. So maybe this could do something like that, where
yeah.
they're not expecting the response.
Perhaps, yeah, and I wonder maybe. Actually if you could program the bots, imagine if the teacher could program the bots with set responses for role plays. So if you were trying to practice very, very specific functional language, like buying train tickets or something, you could program set results from them or set responses.
Yeah, I think you actually can. I think students can create their own bots and do something like that, or perhaps they could program it as an expert on a topic or a vocabulary set, and then they could test each other or interact with each other. Another good thing about these for lower levels is that you kind of reduce that embarrassment factor of speaking in a foreign language. The bot isn't judging you. Well, not yet, anyway. Maybe it will. But as we said, there are limitations with the current technology, but natural language processing is developing rapidly. And according to Matt Schlitt, bot expert and CEO of Octane AI, a company which specializes in making bots, He says, in the future, maybe 5 or 10 years from now, bots will be able to understand you completely.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a really exciting prospect and potentially a massive game changer for the ELT industry. Could it be that chatbots start to replace teachers? Will translation technology become so advanced that there's less of a need to actually learn a language?
Does that mean I'm not going to have a job?
Well, I don't know. I don't know, Frances.
Wow.
But, yeah.
I know.
But yeah, perhaps that's another conversation for another time. Yeah,
on that sobering note.
Right, yeah, interesting stuff. All right. Okay, listeners, over to you. Do you think course books still have a role in the modern classroom, or will process syllabi become the norm? Would you encourage students to talk to a chatbot? Email your comments to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. Okay, next up, we've got Warmer of the Month. Each month, we challenge our guest teacher to explain a fun, communicative activity in no more than 5 steps. So, Frances, what have you got for us?
So, my activity isn't actually a warmer, but a reviewer, and it takes a whole lesson, so about 40, 45 minutes, and it's called Wipeout. First, before the class, you need to prepare a bag of questions, usually about 50 to be safe, and these can be anything from what you've taught in the week to general knowledge or timed questions, whatever you want. As well as 5 wipeout cards, and I'll explain what that is later. So you divide your class into 3 groups, A, B, and C. Group A start, they pick a card, you read the question, they answer it, and if they get it right, they get points. If they don't get it right, it immediately goes to group B, and they try and answer, and if they can't, it goes to group C, and so on and so on. So if they pick out a wipeout card, then they nominate a team to lose all of their points.
Nice. Okay.
So just because you're winning doesn't mean you're going to win at the end. And at the end, the group with the most points is the winner. Should we have a little go?
Okay.
Okay, so Becky, you'll be A.
Okay.
Patrick, you'll be B. Mm-hmm. And Sam, you'll be C.
Okay.
Pick your card.
Okay.
Give me 3 phrases that allow yourself time to think during a speaking activity or exam.
Just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on a sec.
Yep.
Just a minute.
I will allow that. Okay. I'm not sure how effective Sorry, that Sam. Was, but that's okay. Patrick, okay, so general knowledge for you. Name 3 Leonardo DiCaprio films.
Ooh. The Departed.
Yep.
The Basketball Diaries.
Huh? Okay, yeah.
What's Eaten Gilbert Grape.
Okay, very obscure. Titanic? No?
I've never seen it.
Fair enough.
Okay, and finally, Sam.
Okay.
Wipeout.
Nice.
So they've both got 3 points. So it's who you love or who you hate.
I love you, Sam.
Well, okay. I'm gonna have to choose Becca.
Oh my goodness! Why?
Why not?
Okay, so Becca, you've lost all your points. So Patrick, you are the winner.
Thanks, Sam. Thank you.
No worries.
Okay, so obviously that was fun, yeah?
Uh-huh.
But there is rationale behind it, and it's to review and consolidate what you've learned in the class, okay? It's also a very clear way for you and your students to know what they've retained and what they need to go back and review in future lessons. I tend to use this with general English, but it's also really good for exam classes as well, so you don't have to just keep it in general English.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks.
It's now time for Word of the Month. Each month, we discuss a piece of ELT jargon and how it affects teachers. So, Patrick, what can you tell us about Krashen's theory of comprehensible input?
This is a term which was coined by the linguist and educational researcher Stephen Krashen. Krashen, who works at the University of Southern California, developed a theory of second language acquisition, which consists of 5 main hypotheses, one of which is the comprehensible input hypothesis. This states that learners acquire language best when they understand the essence of what is being said or presented to them. Mm-hmm. Krashen divided second language performance into 2 systems, language acquisition and language learning. Acquisition is the subconscious way that children learn a language. Learning is a conscious process which encompasses a more formal knowledge of language, such as grammar rules. And comprehensible input falls under acquisition, and it basically means when the instruction is given by the teacher or when language is presented to students, the language should be 1 step beyond the learner's current stage of competence. This is often referred to as L plus one. Krashen also stated that teachers should involve students by asking questions and encourage students to express their ideas and thoughts in the new language. The focus should be on accuracy of content rather than rigidly correct language use. So to help with this, when a concept is introduced, teachers can provide relevant background knowledge and content and explain an idea several times using slight variations in terminology and examples. The theory being that when input is comprehensible, students understand most aspects of what is required for learning, and the learning experience pushes them to greater understanding. Now, Krashen's theory of comprehensible input was popularised back in the 80s. At the time, many people thought it would crash and burn. But in fact, it's had a large impact in all areas of second language research and teaching since its inception, and continues to do so today.
All right. Thanks very much, Patrick.
My pleasure.
OK, let's move on to this month's interview. This month, Patrick is talking to Hugh Deller and Andrew Walkley about teaching lexically, the London Language Lab, and the future of teacher training.
OK, so Hugh, Andrew, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the show and talk to us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Very nice to have you on. So let's get straight into things. And I wanted to ask you about teaching lexically. So what is it, and why is it important for teachers to know a little bit about this methodology?
So teaching lexically really is about a way of thinking about language. So rather than kind of splitting off grammar and vocabulary and tending to see grammar as the most important thing, with teaching lexically, we think that vocabulary is the most central thing. This is the thing which really improves your language. But it's then also thinking about vocabulary as being quite complex, that it works together with other words and with grammar. And in the way we teach, we need to reflect that complexity. And also in the way we teach, we need to make sure that we're recycling a lot of this vocabulary, revising it a lot. And each time that we revise, we're kind of trying to build our knowledge of how words work. And that kind of leads to kind of the improvements and the way we approach different aspects of our lessons, whether it's speaking, listening, reading, that kind of thing.
You've started up a new school in London, the London Language Lab, and has this teaching lexically, this methodology, has this informed a lot about the school? Can you tell us a little bit about, the school in general, so how you came up with the idea and how it's structured and what makes it a little bit different from other schools?
Yeah, I can. We've both been teaching since the early 90s, and I think for a long time, having worked in a sort of wide range of other language teaching institutions, there's always been a little part of us that's looking at what's going on and thinking how we could do things differently or how we could improve on the way things were done. And at the start of this year, we had a sort of chance encounter with someone who had a building that we were offered space in. And so we've got a lovely kind of two-story space in the centre of London in Bloomsbury. And I guess what makes us different is partly at the moment we're still a very small school. Partly, I think, the fact that the school's been started primarily by ourselves, by teachers, teacher trainers, as opposed to business people looking to kind of turn a quick buck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I have heard rumour of existing in occasion within the English language teaching world. Well, they tell me. And I think, yes, the methodology that we kind of both teach by ourselves very much informs what we're doing in the classroom. I think it's basically the teachers that we employ teach in a very similar style. If someone's away and someone covers the next day, you know you're going to get a very similar kind of approach to language, approach to teaching, approach to working from the students. So I think that makes us quite unusual or quite different in a sense. I think the other things that make us possibly slightly unusual are the way that we try to use London. So we're trying to do more than just have a kind of, you know, pub crawl, look at Big Ben, Buckingham Palace kind of cultural program. Mm-hmm. We're trying to sort of integrate a more adult approach to London, whereby we teach students language and history about certain kinds of aspects of London. So, you know, we might do a week where we do gentrification and we'll look at some language connected to that. We'll look at the concept. We'll go and visit an area together that's being gentrified. We try to encourage the students to interact with places and people that we're going to. So we try and do sort of projects each week where we're looking at different aspects of the city on top of the actual language classes that we're offering.
Okay, so you're using the city as a kind of the environment as a resource, in a sense.
Yeah, much so. And trying to look at it through many different prisms. So, you know, you might do Jewish London, or you might do Muslim London, or you might do, you know, green spaces in London, or, you know, Gothic London, or whatever. And it's trying to sort of allow students to have a deeper understanding of a city that can be quite confusing for lots of students when they first arrive.
Yeah, so you're basically, it's a different kind of, you're using the city as a selling point rather than being more generic in terms of the language.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. No, that sounds fascinating. Well, I'd like to move on to, because you guys obviously have a lot of teaching experience, and I want to move on to teacher training and see, get your thoughts first and foremost on the state of teacher training today, and then also how you think improvements could be made moving into the future.
Teacher training is okay. I think the obvious thing to first say is that any initial training course, whether it's CELTA or Trinity or these kind of short ones aimed at native speaker teachers, essentially they are too short, and everybody, I think, is aware of that. So they offer some preparation, but you know the teachers who come out of them are still in need of further support, which they don't always get in other schools that they work with. So, I mean, one area might be actually just to have some post-CELTA courses, which kind of are a bridge between CELTA and Delta, or those kind of initial courses and diploma courses. I think maybe speaking as somebody who's interested in teaching lexically and the focus on vocabulary and its complexity, I think that those are often initial courses, although there's actually a lot of flexibility within them.
And to be fair, a lot of diversity in the way that people do deliver sentences.
There is, but I think there still can be a tendency for them to focus very heavily on teaching grammar. And, you know, students of these courses often come out thinking this is the most important thing, and that they need to focus on grammar in each lesson in a kind of fairly structured way.
Yeah.
Where we think about it in terms of, obviously, vocabulary is more important, but
what are your communicative goals this lesson?
Yeah, thinking about what you want to say in your lesson. What do you want the students to be able to do after they finish their lesson? And that often involves more of managing both vocabulary and grammar together. And I think also allowing a little bit more space for students and responding to students. So I think that's the other area I think training could be better.
Yeah.
Is, you know, both even in like a diploma courses, I think there needs to be a little bit more space for what you might call spontaneous.
So awareness of a situation, awareness of the students at that time, rather than what you've been taught.
And not feeling that you're being restricted in what you can do because you have to achieve a whole set of pre-stated aims within a kind of very limited, defined period of time.
Sure,
but it's okay to go off on a little tangent.
Yeah, you know, so you respond to what the students say. Maybe a piece of grammar or vocabulary comes up, you exploit that, and that might take you in a completely different route, but it's something where you're following the students and developing their language in that way.
Okay, and that's something that comes through the through actual teaching practice as well. You can't be kind of taught that, the reacting that way can't actually be taught in a pre-sessional course.
No, I think that is kind of true, but I think, actually this is one of the things we're trying to do with our book, Teaching Lexically, is that what you need to think about is how you can start to think about that. So what we do is we take individual little parts of the lesson, say a vocabulary task, and think about the kind of questions you ask about the vocabulary in that task, the opportunities you might have to go off on a tangent, to explore that in those ways. And you do it in a very narrow way. So you might just do it with two or three words where you ask questions which maybe lead somewhere else. And you have a little go at that. And then you can repeat that with any vocabulary task that you do. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you build in, you know, these kind of techniques and
develop your repertoires of approaches.
So right. That you are more able to become spontaneous, if you like. You know, you need to start somewhere, as you say. It does come from practice, but you need to have that message that this is a good thing to do, and you need some support in being able to do it better.
Sure.
One thing on the whole training courses, I think. There was an article recently by a guy called Jason Anderson in ELTJ, who I think studied native and non-native expectations of initial training courses. And unsurprisingly, the conclusion he came to was that a lot of natives look to those courses for language development and language awareness and basic methodological training. A lot of the non-natives are already highly qualified in their own countries and experienced and are looking to those courses to basically be kind of cutting-edge methodology. And I think possibly, you know, a recognition of this and maybe a separation of what's offered to natives and non-natives might be another way forward.
Mm, that's a very interesting point, actually, yeah. But I want to move on to materials writing. Now, you guys have obviously written a lot together. What advice, what's the most important piece of advice you would give to someone, a teacher, who wanted to get into materials writing?
I mean, in a sense, I think the advice would be to start writing. Both of us, long before we were published authors, were writing all manner of juvenilia and trialing it out and seeing how it went. I think on top of that, a really good way of doing it is to find someone that you can work with, whether that means writing together or whether it means you're teaching each other's lessons. Having someone who you trust, who you're kind of learning the art or the craft with, who you can run things by and who can try things out and who can kind of... whose constructive criticism you trust and are prepared to take on board, I think, is a really, really important part of the process. Because I think lots of teachers can write things that work for themselves in their own classrooms. Writing something that I can pick up and take into my classroom is a whole different skill, I think. So working out how to do that is a really important part of the process, I think.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you start actually writing with a publisher or whatever, I mean, you need to understand that there's a whole kind of editing process which takes place, and that is vital. Even when you become experienced and you know you think you're producing something basically usable quite early on, you still benefit from this kind of input from another outside source, somebody else helping
even
you.
Even if you don't always appreciate it at the time,
it always improves.
It does, yeah, that's true.
Absolutely. Brilliant. And one final question for you guys. What changes would you like to see take place in English language teaching in the coming years? Is there anything that we haven't seen, something out of the blue, which you think would make a positive impact on ELT?
It's a really difficult question, I think. I mean, in a sense, a lot of the changes we'd like to see are the kinds of things we've been writing about in our own methodology book. For me personally, the big one I'd like to see is a more mature, sceptical and considered overview of the merits that technology offers us as teachers. Because I think in the last sort of 10 years, I think it's starting to change a little bit, but I think there's been a lot of overexcitement about what technology allows us to do in the classroom. And I think there's been a lot of sort of rapid experimentation that's come out of this as a result of teachers trying all the various new tech tricks and tools. And I think often that's overshadowed any sort of real thought about what language am I trying to teach here? What's the communicative goal of this lesson? What do I want my students to be better able to do? And I think often we've been kind of seduced by some very effective ed tech kind of salespeople. I think there's starting to be a more critical kind of appreciation of the relative benefits of some of that stuff. But I'd like to see more critical appreciation of that, rather than just sort of blind flag waving.
But not using technology just for technology's sake, actually, when you're using it, considering why you're using it.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, listen, it's been fantastic to chat to you and fascinating to hear your insights.
Very
my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Good luck with the school.
Thank you. Thank you.
I look forward to hearing again from you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Love Cheers.
To talk to you. Bye now.
Okay, so one of the things I wanted to pick up on from the interview was the idea of moving outside the classroom and using the city itself as a resource. Hugh gave the example of teaching a topic like gentrification and said that as well as studying the concept and connected vocabulary in class, he also takes his students out to areas that are being gentrified to really, you know, bring the topic to life. So how do you guys feel about using the local environment as a teaching resource? Is that something you've ever tried to do?
Yes, I remember when I was working at a school in London, we had the students compile a survey, and we went to the British Museum and they talked to people there who were visiting the exhibits and asked questions.
Yeah.
And that was really good. They really enjoyed that, I think.
Okay, Frances, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've got mixed feelings about it. And I think it all stems from students' like motivation to be there and their interest. So I think if they have chosen to come to London because they have an interest in London and UK culture, it can totally work. It can be used as part of a course. But I don't think you can make the assumption that people who come here to study are really interested in London. It could be because they are from Europe and geographically it's easier for them to learn in London than it is America. Or that they have different focus and actually they don't really want to learn about the culture or where they're studying.
Yeah, I think another point is a lot of students come and they stay with a host family. And so when they're in the host family's environment, that's when they get to they go out with the host family, visit places and see the city as a resource. I'm not sure whether it falls upon schools to take care of that. The schools are there to provide the classes in school generally, but...
And again, it's the expectation of what these students want to have happen in the classroom is that if they see them sort of going out, doing these excursions or museums, is that what they view to be what they've paid for and what they want?
Okay, so maybe it's better used as an extension outside the classroom. So you can still go to class, still get the same learning outcomes and stuff if you just do class alone. But there's also the, you know, option of going out and doing these kind of cultural trips.
Yeah, I guess it also depends on time of year because let's face facts. I mean, in London, the weather's often quite unpleasant. So why would you want to be outside getting soaked when you could be inside not getting soaked?
Fair point, yeah. Okay, let's move on to Teacher's Dilemma. Each month, we describe a common classroom issue and ask listeners to send in their solutions. So, Becca, what's this month's dilemma?
Okay, you've spent a lot of time planning a brilliant lesson, the majority of which hinges on using several audio recordings. However, when the moment comes to hit the play button, nothing happens. You try again, and nothing happens again. The audio is not working and is not going to work no matter how hard you hit that button over and over again. It's a technology fail! What do you do?
Frances?
Well, I'm pretty sure this has happened to all of us at some point.
Oh, yes.
For me, I think it depends on your aims. Aims of a lesson. Are you aiming to teach listening or speaking skills, or are you aiming to sort of use this audio to introduce a grammar point or vocabulary? If it's listening or speaking, then normally I just sort of turn it into a live listening. So I usually get the audio script and read it in front of them. Usually I apologise, you know, before this, before I do this.
But, and if it's a dialogue, do you put on voices?
I have done, actually.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And actually, sometimes I've found that actually this is quite enjoyable. They find it quite fun. And actually, they're almost more focused on you because they've got something to look at as well as to listen. However, if it's more grammar or vocab, then I usually have a pre-made audio script printed. I usually turn it into a bit of a reading task of identifying the language in the audio script.
Oh, that's good. So that's good backup.
Yeah,
so backup is the key.
Because I think you have to go through the horror of not having the audio script to realise I'm never doing that again.
That's true.
And
never
then
forget.
You have that prep.
Excellent.
Okay, listeners, it's your turn. Send your solutions to this month's dilemma to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. All right, it's Q&A time on the One Stop Podcast, the part of the show in which the panel tries to answer your questions. So you guys ready?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Great. Okay, our first question is this. How do you feel about peer observation? Is it something that should be done on a regular basis?
Well, I am a big fan of peer observation. I think everyone has their own style of teaching. And I think regardless of whether you're really experienced or inexperienced and just come off a CELTA course, I think it's really good to see each other and see the way we teach. I also think it's really good to prepare for big, scary observations as it allows you to sort of get used to someone in the class. And it has that positive association with being observed because normally when you are observed, it's being assessed and it's being critiqued. So I think it allows you to see it as a good thing.
Absolutely. I agree. Yeah, I think also another thing is good for teachers to be able to trial their ideas with another teacher. So they could give them a lesson which works well for them and then see how they teach it differently, if they incorporate anything else, and then maybe they can advise them if something doesn't work properly. So, yeah, good for trialling ideas as well.
Okay, all right. Next question. How do you mark writing? Do you have a marking scheme or do you just correct everything?
First of all, I don't correct everything. I think it can be very intimidating to sort of mark all the errors on a piece of paper, and actually the students can't really process it. But also I think a lot of teachers focus on just correcting the grammar and the vocabulary. And I think with writing, you have to think about other aspects that are important. So are they answering the question? Is the style appropriate? Is the structure okay? But also looking at positive as well as the negative things when marking.
I remember in the previous podcast, we talked about verbal error correction. Yeah. I think it's just the same guiding principles, isn't it? So keep the target language in mind, and that'll keep your feedback nice and focused.
Okay, and our last question this month is, what's the strangest gift you've ever been given by a student?
My one wasn't so strange, it was just a bit of a surprise. It was money, quite a lot of money.
Nice.
Yes,
nice.
In addition to what I was being paid anyway. Yes, I'd helped a student who had to give a speech. His daughter was getting married to a British guy, so he had to give a speech at the wedding, and I'd helped him in the lesson, and he just, at the end, he just slipped over the equivalent of 50 quid in an envelope to me, and I was very surprised, and until I realised I couldn't really accept it, and so gave it back. But yeah, surely nice.
That's really nice. So I once got given a portfolio of photos and comments and pictures of my whole class that one student had been collating for months. So and also, but the weirdest thing was like comments that I say, so the way my instructions that I give, so off you go was like written in, and yeah, so it's loads of time, loads of effort, and I've still got it now.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
Mine wasn't wildly different from that. I was given for my birthday actually a manga art drawing of myself by a student. I mean, what that says about my teaching, maybe he sat at the back of the class sketching, but he actually, came in and found me on my birthday and gave me this drawing of me as a manga character, which if listeners would like to see it, then do email in and I'll send you a picture.
Well, for me, my wife and I used to work in the same school. She was a teacher too, and we both taught the same student in different classes. And he actually found a picture of us together on Facebook and printed it out and put it in a sort of touristy London frame with red buses and pillar boxes, and gave it to me wrapped up, which was nice.
That's lovely.
Do you find it a bit weird, though? They've been stalking you.
I mean, we had obviously added it on Facebook, which was nice, you know, so we were friends, it was okay, but it was unexpected, let's say. Well, that's it for another show. Well done, everyone. But listeners, remember, we need your input. Send in your questions, suggestions, or feedback to onestoppodcast@springernature.com or leave a comment on the One Stop page. Thank you, as always, to our regular panelists.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A big thanks to our guest teacher this month, Frances O'Neill.
Thanks very much.
And of course, thank you for listening. And until next month, this is the One Stop English Podcast.